Hello, this is Charles Calhoun from the Maine Humanities Council, and I'd like to welcome you to another in our series of podcasts exploring the power and pleasure of ideas in Maine. In your program packet, I asked the office to put a copy of W.H. Auden's famous poem, The Shield of Achilles, from 1952. This is a wonderful piece of work that very much expresses the mood of much of the 20th century, certainly the central part of the 20th century, beginning in the 30s and through World War II and into the Cold War as well. And what he does here, if you've had time to read it, if you know it already, is to take the famous scene in the Iliad where Achilles is re-armored, in effect. Hephaestus makes him this fabulous shield, which shows the city at war and the city at peace, and many other rather happy scenes of human life and human endeavor. And his mother gives it to him towards the end of the epic. But what Auden does is to take that Homeric shield and play with it in a way, and to turn it into something. It's a very 1940s shield, or even later, perhaps, in his poetic treatment of it. So the question is, if there were a 21st century Achilles who was trying to do something, a 21st century Auden who was trying to do something similar to this, would it come across as such I won't say depressing poem, but one that's so grim in its own depiction of human endeavor and the human condition? So what we've asked our final speaker this afternoon, Joel Rosenthal, to do is to draw on his own experience running the Carnegie Council in New York, an educational institution, a nonprofit that is very much involved in studying questions of war and peace and conflict resolution in all areas of the world, to ask him to draw on that experience and his own reading of the Iliad and to answer this question, to probe this question at least, have things changed? Have things improved? Are we fated somehow to relive this poem and the Homeric epics over and over again? So please join me in welcoming Joel.
Well, the first thing I'd like to do is thank the organizers for inviting me. I first got to know the Maine Humanities Council, I think around the year 2000, about a dozen years ago. I was actually asked by the National Endowment for the Humanities to come and do what they call a site visit, to come and do an evaluation of the programs of the Maine Humanities Council. And I was overwhelmed at that point in time about what had been accomplished. And I'm not exactly sure what happened, but after that visit, one thing led to another. And I became involved actually quite quickly at the board level. And I will tell you, I am involved with a lot of different organizations in education, in public affairs, throughout the country and throughout the world. And for some reason, and I think it just goes to the quality of the people and the quality of the organization, every time I came up to Portland for a meeting, every time I came home, I remember saying to my wife, I'm so proud to be involved with this organization. This is just a tremendous group of people. The mission is so important. And just means a lot to me. So I was really delighted to be invited back. While I have the microphone, I just want to praise Eric Jorgensen, the staff, Charles. Thank you for the invitation and for the assignment. I will confess to you that when the assignment was given to me, I had to think about it. I hadn't read the Iliad since ninth grade. And I remember discussing it with my executive assistant who does my schedule. And actually, much to my surprise, she looked at me and says, you have to do this. You have to do this. So I have to give her some credit. But it was really a very welcome assignment, and you'll see why. I mean, it forced me to think about what I do and to sort of relate it to this classic text. So you'll know from my opening remarks that I am not a specialist. I am not a classicist. I watched with great admiration and respect for the scholars that you heard from, and you heard from some just tremendous people. And it's with some trepidation that I take the microphone now. It's I'm not sure I really deserve it, but I'll try to add some value to what they said. I will say just quickly, you know, Andrew Carnegie, who founded the Carnegie Council in 1914, actually did have a very specific answer to Roberta's question that she just finished with. It's why he founded the Carnegie Council. Some of you will recognize the year 1914. He founded the council in February of 1914, just before World War I. And he believed that there was actually something that he would call moral evolution or moral progress, and I'm going to talk about that in a minute, that the world was improving, and there were things that we could do to promote a more peaceful world. And at that time, while that sounds very idealistic, he was very practical. He was a very practical man. So he built the Peace Palace at The Hague, and the idea was to have a court. And when nations have disputes, rather than fight it out, there should be a place where they could bring their disputes for a mediated or arbitrated end to the conflict. And then he also was a big supporter of the League of Nations, the idea that there should be mechanisms for collective security to move toward a more peaceful world. So, and that's kind of part of the inspiration behind my remarks today, thinking about that legacy and what it might mean. Now, I want to go back to some of the issues that were raised last evening. And some of what I will say will sound familiar, but I hope I can put it in a way that will both sort of summarize but also add some clarity and maybe a little bit of value to this question of what is Homer for and what are the classics for. So in my view, we read the classics because they tell us something essential about human nature. A classic text endures because it touches on an unchanging truth of human experience. A classic is a time machine. It enables us to travel through time and across cultures, and it speaks to us in a language that we recognize as essential, enduring, and true. The history of the world is the history of violence and war, and the Iliad remains the original benchmark for our understanding of war's human dimensions. As Caroline Alexander said in a talk she gave at the Carnegie Council a couple of years ago and echoed last evening, she said, and I love this phrase, she said, "The epic of the Iliad is much more than a slugging story. The poem invites us to reflect on the nature of war itself and the use of force as it shapes our understanding of virtues such as honor and responsibility, and vices such as excessive pride, vengeance, and cruelty." So I want to focus my remarks on the questions raised by Simone Weil in her essay, famous essay on the Iliad, which was actually a response in some ways to Roberta's question. The title of her essay was "The Iliad or the Poem of Force," which was written in 1939, note the date, 1939 in France, note the location. Writing under the shadow of Nazi and fascist regimes, regimes who lionized military power and saw weakness as akin to illness, they asked, "Is force inevitably all-controlling and malevolent, or can it be tamed? Is it possible, in Vey's words, to learn not to admire force, not to hate the enemy?" I suppose if she were here, she would say to learn how to play checkers instead of go to war. So my focus arises from new attention given to these questions by Steven Pinker and others who use historical data and insights from brain science and moral psychology to suggest that violence is in decline. In his new book, the better angels of our nature, Pinker uses statistical evidence to show that over the centuries, human beings have become less inclined to kill each other and to engage in barbarous and cruel practices. As Pinker puts it, and I quote, think about this, brutal customs, once commonplace, have been abolished. Cannibalism, human sacrifice, heretic burning, chattel slavery, punitive mutilation, sadistic executions. None of these things are done anymore. Battle deaths worldwide have declined drastically. The rate of death has plunged from 300 per 100,000 of world population during World War II to fewer than 1 per 100,000 in the 21st century, from 300 to 1. Pinker does not suggest that we are reaching a state of perpetual peace. Rather, he concludes, and I quote, we still harbor demons like greed, dominance, revenge, and self-deception, but we also have faculties that inhibit them, like self-control, empathy, reason, and a sense of fairness, end of quote. And as Pinker argues, it's these latter faculties, empathy, reason, fairness, these faculties seem to be winning out, according to the empirical evidence. Pinker's provocative argument suggests that we might benefit from revisiting conventional ideas about human impulses towards conflict and cooperation. They, like many before her, emphasizes the base, vulgar instincts that lead us to fight not only for self-defense, but also for conquest. However, could it be that human beings are hardwired for cooperation just as much as for conflict? After all, doesn't human survival depend on cooperation as much, if not more, than conflict? Pinker leads us to consider aspects of both nature and nurture that emphasize the capacity to cooperate. A nature argument for cooperation suggests we take seriously the moral instinct of empathy and the human capacity for reason. A nurture argument for cooperation suggests that standards and expectations have evolved in light of experience, that human society has created new rules and new institutions to reflect a kind of moral evolution. However we answer these questions, it seems logical to consult first with Homer. Homer provides a reference point, a point of reckoning. Do we want to make a case for moral progress when it comes to the use of force, violence, and war? And this is a question I hope we can consider together. So Simone Weil begins by reminding us of Homer's subject, and I'm going to read to you just the first paragraph of her essay. The true hero, the true subject, the center of the Iliad is force. Force employed by man, force that enslaves man, force before which man's flesh shrinks away. In this work, at all times, the human spirit is shown as modified by its relations with force, as swept away, blinded by the very force it imagined it could handle, as deformed by the weight of the force it submits to. For those dreamers who considered that force, thanks to progress, would soon be a thing of the past, the Iliad could appear as a historical document. For those whose power of recognition are more acute and who perceive force today, as of yesterday, at the very center of human history, the Iliad is the purest and the loveliest of mirrors. Iliad as a mirror. The value of the Iliad, according to Vey, is Homer's realism, his unsentimental treatment of war. And as you've heard from some of the other speakers, and I'm sure that you took yourself, mayhem reigns. Barbarity is accepted matter-of-factly by the leaders, the soldiers, and especially the gods. I'm sure that you, like me, were struck by the many graphic descriptions of spearing, disemboweling, and the like. Veins, arteries, tendons, vital organs are described in detail as countless lives are lost. Parts of the text, as we already heard, are literally blood-soaked. Bernard Knox, in his introduction to the Fagles edition, mentions the scene that stuck with me in this regard, that of Patroclus' slaying of Thestor. I'll just read the paragraph. Patroclus, rising beside him, stabbed his right jawbone, ramming the spearhead square between his teeth so hard, he hooked him by that spearhead over the chariot rail, hoisted, dragged the Trojan out as an angler perched on a jutting rock drags some fish from the sea. Some noble catch, with line and glittering bronze hook. So with the spear, Patroclus gaffed him off his car, his mouth gaping round the glittering point, and flipped him down face first, dead as he fell, his life's breath blown away. And if that were not enough, Patroclus goes on to dispatch 10 more Trojans in the next few lines, punctuated by the killing of Eurylus. He flung a rock and it struck between his eyes, and the man's whole skull split in his heavy helmet. Down the Trojan slammed on the ground, head down, and courage-shattering death engulfed his corpse. So war is hell. You get the picture. What may surprise the modern reader is how routine it seems and how cavalierly it is accepted. Homer goes beyond the cruelty to point out another element of war that is just as relevant to our understanding of it. While war may be hell, it is also intoxicating. It fills us with adrenaline. Because it requires so much self-sacrifice and effort, because it fills men with some elevated notions of duty and camaraderie, war becomes noble and even beautiful. It is the place, as Homer says, where men win glory. And some of you will recognize that phrase. It was the phrase that John Krakauer used in his biography of Pat Tillman. The title of the book is Where Men Win Glory. In book two, Homer writes, her shield of lightning dazzling, swirling around her, headlong Athena swept through the Argive armies, driving soldiers harder, lashing the fury, fighting in each Achaean's heart, no stopping them now, mad for war and struggle. Now suddenly battle thrilled them more than the journey home, more than sailing hollow ships to their dear native land. As ravening fire rips through the big stands of timber high on a mountain ridge and the blaze flares miles away, so from the marching troops the blaze of bronze armor, splendid and superhuman, flared across the earth, flashing into the air to hit the skies. That's in book two. War binds men together in a set of trying circumstances that cannot be duplicated. This is just what Roberta was talking about. They become attracted, if not addicted, to its energy. Contemporary journalists have examined this response in great detail. Christopher Hedges has written the book, War is the Force That Gives Us Meaning, where he describes war as a drug and a vehicle that engages lust and passions. He describes the odd beauty of war, what he calls the lust of the eye, that appreciates the awesome spectacles of war machines and their destructive powers. If any of you have ever stood on the bridge of an aircraft carrier or seen a naval fleet at sea, you'll understand what he means. The power and capacity of these vessels is an awesome sight to behold. Hedges emphasizes the solidarity that emerges among men who bond over the powerful instruments they command and the dangers they face together. Sebastian Junger takes up these themes in his recent book, War, based on his embedded journalist experience with the U.S. Army in Afghanistan. In a talk at the Carnegie Council not long ago, this is what he had to say, and I quote Sebastian Junger, "I went over there and I thought it was going to be exciting, glamorous, and intense, being a reporter in a war zone. And it was all those things. One of the things I became interested in is this strange reality. War is a terrible thing. It kills people. It ruins society. It's just obviously bad. We are all in agreement about that. So why is it also to some people so attractive? What is it about humans, men in particular?" End of quote. Junger speculates on a variety of factors that draw men to war: thrill, adventure, duty, brotherhood. The experience of war is intense, and some cannot let it go. The Academy Award-winning movie, The Hurt Locker, focused on the theme of the magnetic attraction to war. Those of you who've seen it, you know at the end of the film, the protagonist, who's repeatedly volunteered for and survived the most hazardous duty imaginable, cannot abide the peacefulness of home upon the end of his tour of duty. He must go back. Like the moth to the flame, he's addicted to the danger and to the fight. Bernard Knox sums up Homer's realism this way: 3,000 years have not changed the human condition in this respect. We are still lovers and victims of the will to violence. And so long as we are, Homer will be read as its truest interpreter. Lovers and victims of the will to violence. I think that's a phrase worth thinking about. The lover part might be hard to accept, but I think it would be foolish to deny. In addition to the perverse attraction to war, there is also a deeply ingrained idea that war is inevitable. Friedrich Nietzsche cited human nature as the source of this acceptance. There was, Nietzsche said, a will to power that is inescapable. Ancient and modern political philosophers expressed this idea, the same idea, in different ways. Thucydides observed that men resort to war for three reasons, reasons that will never change. These three reasons: interests, meaning the material benefit, fear, and honor. Thomas Hobbes observed that in the state of nature, meaning the natural world, there's no controlling authority. And according to Hobbes, we live in an anarchic and unstable world where in pre-modern times, you'll probably all know the phrase, life was solitary, nasty, brutish, and short. Contemporary realists take this idea to mean that we live in a world of competition and constant threats that create a structural security dilemma. We can never trust opponents not to press their advantage, so we must always be willing to fight to maintain our power position. Homer presents war as a choice of the gods. And I know this has been a theme we've been talking about. Let me just try to add a little to this. As such, war seems to be a force beyond human reach, somehow foreordained, predestined, inescapable. For example, Achilles agrees to join the fray to avenge the death of Patroclus only after, prompted by the goddess Thetis and the gift of armor she bestows on behalf of the gods. When Achilles finally swears off his rage, Agamemnon offers a final excuse for his troubles with Achilles. And in Book 19, this is what Agamemnon says. He blames the gods. He says, "Often the armies brought this matter up against me. They would revile me in public. But I am not to blame. Zeus and fate and the fury stalking through the night, they are the ones who drove the savage madness in my heart. The gods made me do it." That day in assembly when I seized Achilles' prize on my own authority, true, but what could I do? A god impels all things to their fulfillment. By making war a choice of the gods, Homer seems to be indicating that the mortals cannot control behaviors and outcomes. The impulses come from above and below. The philosopher Sean Kelly makes an interesting point about this. As modern readers, we're used to the idea that individual actors should take responsibility for their actions. However, Kelly says that Homer's characters are, by contrast, primitive. The gods are great forces outside of the human experience, and yet it is they who determine the outcomes. The gods represent the best and the worst, and they show us both the possibilities and limitations of human behavior. If nothing else, the gods remind us of the overwhelming powers of the natural world that are greater than ourselves. They are in some ways very human in that they pursue rivalries and jealousies. Their actions mirror the trials and tribulations of the mortals they direct. However, in the end, they are gods. They live in perpetuity to continue never-ending cycles of conflict and emotion that transcend the life of any single individual. So these cycles live on through the gods. The interaction of gods and mortals reaches its dramatic peak in the most famous scene of all, Achilles' slaying of Hector and the defilement of Hector's body. The defilement of Hector's body tests this line of humanity that we've been talking about. On the one side, we have unmitigated barbarity. On the other side, we have some measure of respect and empathy. Hector recognizes this test of humanity before he is slain. This is in book 22. Hector says to Achilles, "I beg you, beg by your life, your parents, don't let the dogs devour me by the Argive ships. Wait, take the princely ransom of bronze and gold, the gifts my father and mother will give you. But give my body to friends to carry home again, so Trojan men and Trojan women can do me honor with fitting rites of fire once I am dead." Of course, Achilles is having none of it. After killing Hector, Achilles proceeds to desecrate the body. And Homer describes this in detail. Again, book 22. "So he, Achilles, triumphed. And now, bent on outrage, on shaming noble Hector, piercing the tendons, ankle to heel, behind both feet, he knotted the straps of rawhide through them both, lashed them to his chariot, left the head to drop. Having strung Hector to his chariot, Achilles proceeds to haul him three times around Patroclus's tomb and then keeps the corpse in this degraded state for good measure while Patroclus's funeral is being prepared." But this is too much, even for the indifferent and sometimes cruel gods. Apollo offers protection to the rotting body. He warded all corruption from Hector's corpse, and round him, head to foot, the great god wrapped the golden shield of storm so his skin would never rip as Achilles dragged him on. Even Zeus registers his disgust. Zeus says of Achilles, book 24, this is Zeus, "What good will it do him? What honor will he gain? Let that man beware, or great and glorious as he is. We mighty gods wheel on him in anger. Look, he outrages the senseless clay in all his fury." So the gods leave us with a clear message. In war, there is such a thing as atrocity. Atrocity begins with the dehumanization of the other. In his writings on totem and taboo, Sigmund Freud included an entire section called The Treatment of Enemies, which was written in the 1910s. This is what Freud wrote, and I'm quoting Freud. "Inclined as we may have been to ascribe to savage and semi-savage races uninhibited and remorseless cruelty toward their enemies. It is of great interest to learn that with them too, the killing of a person compels the observation of a series of rules which are associated with taboo customs. Freud goes on to chronicle numerous examples of pre-modern cultures that have elaborate rituals for respecting the dead. For example, and I quote Freud again, when the Sidiaks of Sarawak bring home the dead from a war expedition, they treat it for months with the greatest kindness and courtesy and address it with the most endearing names in their language. The best morsels from their meals are put into its mouth together with tidbits and cigars. It would be a great mistake to think that any derision is attached to this treatment, horrible though it may seem to us. End of quote. To the contrary, this treatment of the dead body is in fact a sign of respect. What Freud is saying is this: for death to have meaning, it must be marked in a way that pays respect to the fundamental breach that has occurred by the taking of the life itself. So taboo is one way to think about this. We assign a certain forbidden tag to these breaches of humanity and civilization. Honor may be another way to express the same idea. Honor is a virtue used to reinforce virtuous acts, dishonor the result of less than virtuous behavior. Honor is Homer's tool for drawing the line between humanity and barbarity. There is a line, and it is important. We see this idea very much alive in today's news. Just a few weeks ago, a video appeared of four U.S. Marines urinating on the bodies of the corpses, urinating on the corpses of three Taliban fighters. According to media reports, the response to the video was universal moral outrage and shame. This response, widely shared around the world, and not least from military professionals themselves, had its roots in the recognition that this act of desecration was not only a violation of a professional code of conduct, it was a transgression of a basic moral requirement to respect the dead. We might ask ourselves why the United States and its allies go to such great lengths to enforce these norms, especially when our opponents make such a great show out of violating them. The Taliban in Iraq, Pakistan, and Afghanistan is famous for its beheadings. Many of you will remember the grisly video of the execution of Nicholas Berg and reports of the beheading of Daniel Pearl. You'll also remember photos of burnt corpses hanging from a bridge in Fallujah in Iraq. Of course, who can forget the images of the dead U.S. Army Rangers being dragged through the streets of Mogadishu, Somalia, after the Black Hawk Down mishap? Examples of defilement are really too numerous to mention. I think it's precisely the fact that we seek to separate ourselves from this kind of behavior that we try to be vigilant in stopping it where we can. We do not want to be like the Taliban. We do not want to be like the Libyan rebels who beat and killed their deposed leader on the streets of Tripoli. This is why the tales of abuse in the prisons of Abu Ghraib, Bagram, Guantanamo touched a nerve for so many. This is why mass killings in places like Haditha during the Iraq War, in My Lai during the Vietnam War, trouble us so much. Abuse is dishonorable, and it is the virtue of honor that we should seek as decent and civilized human beings. Marines urinating on corpses is as old as war itself. The fundamental urge for revenge is understandable. Exhaustion and fear take their toll. Young men must, in some way, delegitimize their enemy. Otherwise, how can they be asked to take their lives unless they are deemed somehow unworthy to live? Homer's depiction of Achilles' rage helps us to understand this. In order to fight, the hero must see the enemy as deserving of death. However, even in death, there are limits. Even in death, or perhaps especially in death, there is an affirmation of certain values and principles. The issue of dealing with corpses is a reminder that while we may be realists, we are not nihilists. We do find meaning in death as we do in life. How else can we explain the obverse of the defilement of battle victims? That is, why do we go to such great lengths to recover the dead bodies of our compatriots? Why do Army Rangers and Marines risk life and limb to recover dead bodies? Our military and many others stress the importance of never leaving behind a fallen comrade. This promise is deep in the code of military culture. It is perhaps the primal value. No one is left behind. Again, we see examples ancient and modern. In 1992, the Rangers in Mogadishu would not conclude their operation until the bodies of their brothers in arms were recovered. In 2004, the Israeli government famously released over 400 Palestinian and Lebanese prisoners to Hezbollah in Lebanon in exchange for the bodies of three dead IDF soldiers whose remains had been held for over 3 years. In our poem, Priam is willing to risk his life and pay a huge ransom for the dead body of Hector. It may be true that the more things change, the more they remain the same. Achilles eventually realizes that his defilement of Hector's body was bringing not honor, but shame. He recognizes in Priam the sadness of the father mourning the son. When Priam comes to Achilles asking for the return of Hector's corpse, Achilles says to him, this is book 24, as was just mentioned before, "Poor man, how much you've borne, pain to break the spirit. What daring brought you down to the ships all alone to face the glance of the man who killed your sons, so many fine, brave boys? You have a heart of iron. Come, please sit down on this chair here. Let us put our griefs to rest in our own hearts." This is the moment of breakthrough of humanity. We too today have our moments of transgression. Achilles' final act gives us some indication of how we should respond. Through Achilles, Homer is telling us to recognize the humanity in others, even our enemies. The act of respecting the dead is but one, perhaps small, way to show this. Finally, this is my last section here, if there are some aspects of war that are unchanging, are there some aspects of war that evolve? That is, to return to the question raised by Steven Pinker, are the values we bring to war today really the same as they were back in the days of the Argives, Achaeans, and Trojans? Or have we evolved morally? I think the evidence given to us by Homer in his poem and the headlines we read in today's newspapers leads to an answer of yes and no. My no, that we haven't changed, rests on the cases I just mentioned. We still see untold cruelties, humiliation, and shame due to war. The brutalities continue, accompanied by emotions ranging from rage and vengeance to self-sacrifice and heroism. As long as there is war, there will be violence and transgressions of this kind. This is 100% predictable. But my yes, and here's where we can try to end on a, perhaps a positive note, although I think it's going to be up to you. My yes in favor of some sort of evolution is based on just two observations, and these are just observations. So your observations are as good as mine. So the first is that despite the realities of ongoing atrocity, we do see a change over the centuries in terms of the norms of war. By norms, I mean rules. Norms are expected and required behavior. When it comes to war, I would argue, or I'll try to argue, that our expectations have indeed risen over the centuries. The just war tradition of the Middle Ages evolved into the beginnings of international law in the early modern period. These efforts began a process of codifying permissions and restraints. Eventually, the Geneva Conventions in the mid-19th century brought us into the modern world, where we recognize principles such as the protection of innocent civilians, the proper treatment of prisoners, and care and wounded for the displaced. International humanitarian law is not always decisive in determining what happens in conflict zones. However, from an ethical perspective, it seems widely accepted as an essential point of reference. It is impossible to have a discussion of war in the 21st century without reference to the moral imperatives of principles such as non-combatant immunity, discrimination in targeting, and proportionality in the use of force. This is the way we think about it now. My second observation is that in addition to the changing norms and expectations, war itself has evolved. The industrial wars of the 20th century, massive total wars between states, have given way to localized internal conflicts. Rather than industrial war, we have today what General Rupert Smith, the former chief of staff of the British Armed Forces, calls wars among the people. This is not to say that war is any less brutal than it was previously. It is only to suggest that the old ways of thinking about wars, large armies on battlefields deployed like chess pieces, is most likely a thing of the past. Force will continue to be used to maintain order in a still chaotic world, but the type of force and its application is likely to be quite different than in the past. I think it's reasonable to suggest that the wars of the 21st century might look more like cooperative policing than the wars of times past. And I think that's what Andrew Carnegie would like to think. Threats now come from small groups in relatively small, weak states. Terror networks resemble criminal gangs and organized crime more than opposing armies. It's hard to imagine that given the values and interests of the powerful nations in the world today, that an old-fashioned World War II industrial war would be pursued. If this is so, if this is indeed the future of war, it might be possible to do better than we have in the past when it comes to upholding certain rules and norms. We may not perform to our ideal norms. We may often fall short. But perhaps Pinker is correct. Perhaps our performance is getting better because our values are shifting toward a more demanding set of expectations. Whatever you decide on this question of moral progress, there is no escape from the fundamental aspects of the human experience of war that are, in some ways, unchanging. Human emotions and sentiments are both time-bound, but also timeless. We have no better example of this than an encounter with a text like the Iliad. I hope that, like me, you finish the poem with a sense that we have come a long way in 3,000 years, and yet we still have a long way to go. For me, there's excitement in that, and I suppose there's also some comfort in recognizing that our struggles are similar to the ones faced by those who came before us and those who will come after. So thank you all for your attention.
This podcast was brought to you by the Maine Humanities Council, with support from the National Endowment for the Humanities and Friends Like You. Thanks for listening, and thanks for your support.